Class, and you're listening to It's All About Food. And welcome today. I want to make a disclaimer before we get started. Do not listen to this particular show on an empty stomach. We're going to be talking about lots of yummy, delicious foods and great recipes. And very often on the show, I talk about food choices and how food affects health, environment, and the treatment of animals. We get really serious about a lot of serious issues, but right now, I want to lighten it up and talk about the beautiful thing about eating delicious, healthy plant foods. And I want to welcome Chet Minkwon, our guest. He grew up in Bangkok, Thailand. He has apprenticed in provincial French cuisine at La Cagouille in Rayon, France, and traveled extensively in Southeast Asia and worked in restaurants in the San Francisco area. Currently, he runs Unusual Touch, a business specializing in catering, food consulting, and restaurant design, Thai cooking classes, and culinary expositions to Thailand. He's the author of the cookbooks Buddhist Table, Vietnamese Fusion, and Asian Fusion. Welcome, Chet.
Sawadee Khrap.
Excuse me?
Sawadee. Hello.
Hi. Here. Welcome.
Hi. Sawadee in Thai means hello.
Oh, is that what you were saying?
That's right.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to ask you, I noticed in the beginning of your book, Asian Fusion, you end with lots of different words, and I'm assuming they all mean thank you in different languages.
Correct, yes.
Arigato, kamon, chezuba, etc.
Yes, it's all thank you in Asian cuisine, Asian language.
Well, I think it's nice to know how to say thank you in so many different ways.
Yes, at least you need to know how to say hello and thank you.
Yes, that's a good beginning. And so here we are at the beginning of this show, and I've really been looking forward to talking with you because I love your books and love what you're doing. One of the things I wanted to say, I'm always encouraging people to eat more fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, raw nuts and seeds, all those beautiful plant foods. And one of the exciting things about becoming global and learning more about other countries and being able to travel is we discover all of the different ways to prepare plant foods.
Right.
And, you know, when people think about transitioning from a meat and potato-based diet and they have no imagination and can't imagine what to do with plants, and you open the door and all of a sudden the variety just rushes in. And
yes.
I think we don't see enough cookbooks that show us how to prepare all of the different Asian style foods, and so I'm glad that you've put out a few books on this subject. One of the nice things about Asian food I find is that it is very high in very healthy vegetables, and it's a very, very healthy cuisine.
Correct, because we use a lot of all kind of vegetable in our meals.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of eat a big chunk of meat, right, you cut all those meat up into small pieces and add a lot of vegetable to it to quantify the volumes of it, okay? And when you become vegetarian, you cut the meat out and you still have a lot of vegetable that's been cut up into small pieces.
It's an easier transition than from an American diet from meat to vegetables.
Correct. Okay. And all you have to do, you have to find the right seasoning for it to make it as good as the meat version of it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And we have so many substitutions out there, okay, to make it taste as good as the meat version.
Or better.
Or better. There we go. Okay.
Okay.
And because of the Asian food, we all cut up everything into small pieces, so it's easy to prepare, okay,
mm-hmm.
and it's make them cook evenly when we heat them up, and so the flavor of the seasoning, you know, get into the ingredients better. And at the same time, when we serve, well, I always told my student that when you serve Asian food, you don't need knives anymore on the dining table.
It just made me think of something. Normally when I eat I guess what I'd call continental food or American-style food. I really like to have different things separate on the plate. I like to have my vegetables separate from my potatoes, separate from my beans, all separate. I'm personally not into mixing. But I love Asian food, and most of the dishes are all mixed up. But I think it's that finely chopping that makes the difference for me.
Yes, and it makes the textures and the taste and thing that when it's kind of multi-texture and multi-flavor, you know, when you put it in your mouth and then you eat it from there. So we don't need knife anymore on the table to cut up anything. We just need spoon and fork or sometimes chopstick just for the eating utensil.
Okay, now I never assume anything, but you've put out a number of different vegetarian books. Are you a vegetarian?
Yes, at one point. When I start writing vegetarian cookbook, I became vegetarian for many years.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And now just to get my foot in the door and still in terms of culinary field, I do eat meat occasionally.
Okay.
To taste the recipe.
Sometimes those are things you have to do, especially when you want to help other people move to eating more plant foods.
Correct, yeah, that's right.
And so your shift to eating more plant foods, was that based on any particular reason?
Well, there's many reasons. One of them is that when I eating meat, a lot of meat, you know, back about 7-8 years ago, I don't feel very good about myself.
Mm-hmm.
My digestive system probably couldn't handle it that well in terms of digesting protein or meat products. Right? And when I turned to vegetarian, it seemed to be a lot better for me.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, and in fact, in Asia, especially Southeast Asia, when people getting older, they will turn into vegetarians.
Really?
Yes.
They know
old
that.
People will, yeah, old people will do that because, several reasons. One of the reasons is that they follow Buddhist teaching strictly. You know, mm-hmm. that we shall not kill, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So they don't eat meat from there. And then mostly they have found out that when they eat more vegetable, it's easy on their digestive system.
Right.
Yeah.
So as we get older, we get, some of us anyway, get smarter and realize what we need to do to feel good.
That's right. Uh-huh. So yeah. after you eat so much meat and then you don't feel comfortable about yourself, you know, so you change the diet and then vegetable seems to be agree with you more, so they keep it that way. So that's why old people in Asia become vegetarian more.
That's really interesting. I didn't realize that. Okay. And so then you started eating more vegetable foods, and you're originally from Thailand.
From Thailand, yes, originally.
And you came to the United States to go to...
I came to study architecture. Okay.
Yeah.
I was in college, I just still try to find Thai food to eat.
Uh-huh.
And then it's basically try to find ingredients. At that time, it's kind of difficult to find ingredients for Thai cooking.
Now it's pretty easy. There are Thai restaurants like popping up every other week, it seems.
Now it's almost everywhere you can find Thai ingredients. Doesn't matter where you live, okay, in the United States. You still be able to get them very easily.
Now, I noticed you studied at La Cagouille in France, and it says Rayon, France. Where is that?
It's near the alluvial, okay, where the water of the river came out in the west of France, and is where they have clam, oyster, and farming's there a lot. But
right. I'm familiar with the famous restaurant La Cagouille in Paris. It's a seafood restaurant.
Yeah.
I
La, La, go ahead.
I lived in the south of France in Aix-en-Provence for 4 years as a vegan. I didn't eat any of the conventional foods, but I looked at a lot of food and got many, many ideas. And it's certainly interesting training with what they do with fresh vegetables.
Correct, yeah. They basically pick it out from the farm or from the fields and use them right away.
What a concept.
That's amazing. That's what I found. Yeah, very nice and fresh, yeah.
No, really, if you want real flavor in food,
that's right.
You just eat it from the farm. It doesn't need anything, practically, little. But unfortunately, most of us buy food in the supermarket that has no taste, and it's no wonder that
correct.
We have to load up with salt, sugar, and fat.
Salt, yeah. Another seasoning to enhance the flavor, yeah. I remember when I was in France, I ate, they make me the strawberry pie, the fresh strawberry pie.
Mm-hmm.
They just pick them up, you know, from the farm and put it on the crust, and then we eat them fresh. And it's so sweet. And it's, I never had anything like that in my life.
That's
still
interesting. I was visiting France maybe 2 years ago, I think, and I was in the Bordeaux region near the coast visiting a friend, and we bought some strawberries that I've never tasted strawberries like these. And I've had many strawberries in the Bay Area in Watsonville, where so many of them grow, but these strawberries, nothing like it. They were so perfumed.
Correct, yes. They have this distinctive flavor, distinctive taste, and it's just like, and every one, single one of them are tasting the same one, you know, better than the other. Over here, when you buy strawberry, one of them might be sweet, the other one might not be, you know, the quality of it. But over there, it seemed to be consistently, every single one of them. That's amazing.
Right. What do we do about that?
Well, we just have to encourage, you know, homegrown more. Do it in your backyard. A little patch of soy will be enough to grow strawberry to feed your family.
Well, I just want to say I live in New York City, and I have a small terrace, and I grow things every spring and summer. And this is the first year I'm growing strawberries, and I have a little plant, and it's got maybe 8 little strawberries. They're tiny. They haven't grown yet, but I'm very excited about it.
Yeah. Well, the same goes with tomatoes. You know, it's like you have a small plot of soil, you can grow tomatoes in your home, in your backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have the best taste tomatoes for your family.
Now, reading your biography, it's funny almost how you got into food, because you really didn't enjoy it when you were young.
No, in fact, I detested it so much when I was young.
But you learned.
Correct. Well, the story is that because I'm the youngest one of the family, right? So my brother and sister, who are older than me, always find a way to avoid cooking by use an excuse that they always had something to do, okay? So after you run down the order of hierarchy, it ended up that I have to be the one because I'm the youngest one.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to help my aunts and to cook. My aunt is the one who's a chef of the house, the cook of the house at that time. So I help her almost every day, okay? And when I was that young, I not that enjoy it that much. So every time we do something, I always spice it up just to get back at my siblings.
But you like...
So if I make some any recipe that have chilies in it, okay, I will put more chili than my aunt will ask for. Yeah. So I make it so hot that, you know, it's unbearable for everyone to eat. Yeah. So every time they serve the food, you know, it's so hot, but it's also good, okay? So you don't know if to praise me or to punish me.
Right. That's very clever. You were clever when you were young.
So I got away with it, yes.
Yeah. But at some point you started to enjoy preparing food.
Correct. Yeah, after I do it for a while, after the praise of all around people who taste my food, you know, say, well, is it good? And they encourage me to do more, to do better things. So I start to gain more knowledge and start to like it, okay,
mm-hmm.
cooking, and just go from there.
Is there a different philosophy behind cooking in Asia than we have here in the United States?
Yes. Well, for Asian philosophy, food is also mean giving nourishment.
Oh.
Okay, giving, you know, like if you care for someone, you give them food.
Hmm.
And it's always confusing love, you know, with food, because most of the Asian mother, well, I have to say in general here, okay, sometimes
mm-hmm.
they don't know how to express love in another way, but they give food instead.
Sure.
So okay. when the children come home, you know, the first thing they always ask, are you hungry?
I think all mothers do that.
Yeah, and then, but Asian mother is very especially doing that. And then even though you say, no, I'm not hungry, but she still want to feed you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, just to show that, well, because I care for you and giving you food, that is a part of my love for you. And it's been doing that for generation and generation. So you always start
mm-hmm.
in Thailand. You always start saying, instead of saying hello to anyone, okay, when you meet each other, you always ask, have you eaten yet? Yeah. And then if you say, I'm already ate, and you say, no, let's try this. Try this and that, you know, I made or you made. So you always have food in every meeting, every getting get-together.
Mm.
So food has become a part of this culture. Yeah. So if you invite it to someone home, they always have to have food.
So I love many different kinds of Asian food. I love Vietnamese food, Thai food, Chinese food, Japanese food, Indian food. But I do encourage people to make food at home for so many reasons. And one of my particular issues when I eat out, is, especially Asian food, is it's too salty. And there's a lot of soy sauce or a lot of salt. And I frequently come home and I can't drink enough water because I'm just not used to eating things that are so salty. So it's great to be able to make these foods yourself, because once you get the hang of it, I think they're pretty simple, and then you can adjust the flavors the way you like them.
Yes. Well, the thing is, all seasoning in Asian cooking have salt in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a matter of soy sauce, you know, soy paste. Some of them use salt as preservative.
Right.
So that means when you're using it, you need to figure out how much salt already in there, and then you're going to put some more salt on top of that. It's
mm-hmm.
going to make it very salty.
Yeah, too
and
salty.
Also, yeah, and also it's a bad rap about Asian cooking is MSG. Okay?
Is in the what?
Is in MSG is in the food
oh,
also.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's right. So that also is a culprit to make you thirsty after you eat a lot of Asian food.
Yeah. Fortunately, more and more restaurants here in the United States
yeah,
are not
right.
using MSG.
Yeah, they try to avoid it, cut it down. But in some of the seasoning also have MSG.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need any more MSG. It's already in some of the seasoning itself.
Right. Oh, goodness. So
you just have to look on the bottle and see that if you're allergic to it or you don't like it at all in terms of your body react to it, then you just have to avoid it completely. But there are many, many brands, many soy, many seasoning out there don't use MSG as the components or the ingredients.
You have a great list in the beginning of your books. I'm looking at the Asian Fusion book right now, and you describe all the different ingredients, herbs and spices and soy products, etc. And I have to say I'm familiar with most of them because Yeah, I've been working on preparing all kinds of vegan food for a very long time, and some of these ingredients are really essential. There's a few, though, that I've heard of, but I have yet to use, and one of them is asafoetida.
Okay.
Is that easy to find? Is it really something I should include in my pantry?
This is very easy to find. Okay, mm-hmm. It's kind of the herbs that some of them ground up. It gives you a kind of unique flavor to your food. But if you cannot find them, then you don't have to use it. Okay, you can skip it.
Mm-hmm.
It comes in the dry form, so it's easy to transport or easy to keep. Okay, it's not an essential ingredient, but if you want it to be kind of different than the other dish.
Right.
You know, because sometimes they have the same ingredients. So if you want this to be a little bit more unique, then you can use that. If you cannot find them, then it's still okay. Okay?
Yeah.
It's not a major breaker of the deal in terms of cooking a dish up.
Another one I have to try, but I haven't looked for it, and I'm sure I could find it because I live in New York City and I'm in the Asian markets all the time. But it's the galangal.
Oh, yes.
The Siamese ginger.
Those are very key ingredients in Thai cooking. You need to have those in order to make it Thai.
Mm-hmm.
You can use ginger to substitute it. Galangal is the rhizome, the same family as ginger, but it tastes so much different. Okay, it gives you a kind of ginger-like, but it also have garlic and onions and other flavor into it, and some a little anise and peppery. So if you're going to make the Thai soup or Thai curry, you need to have that in it. Okay, and
mm-hmm.
you can find them fresh at the Asian grocery store or in the dry goods section. It can be dry in the pieces, or it can be also in ground in bottles. So I think you can find them almost anywhere now.
Right. I'm going to make a promise to myself to look for it this week. I've been wanting to get some, and I just keep forgetting when I go to those special markets.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I have a question. You cover so many different countries in this Asian Fusion book: Burma, China, Japan, Korea, Laos, India, Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, Sri Lanka. I just flipped through the Indonesia section, and I'm just curious. I haven't seen any tempeh in any of your recipes. Is that true?
Yeah.
And is there a reason for that?
Because sometimes you have difficulty finding it, okay, in some part of it. Because, or if you can be able to find it, then you can use it like a soy paste.
Mm-hmm.
You can use those also.
Because
okay.
I know that it's so, I haven't been to many of these countries, but I heard that it was originated in Indonesia, so.
Correct, yeah.
Kind of wondering about that.
Did you be able to find them in your Asian markets in your neighborhood?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you okay?
Yeah.
Then you should be able to use them like you use soy paste, maybe to give it a flavor.
Okay.
So the reason I didn't ask for it because some of the recipe did not require for it, so we use soy instead to make
right.
it a little bit easier. Yeah.
Okay.
But in fact, talk about soy. We have so many kinds of soy out there. This is sometimes it's overwhelming to choose which one you're going to use.
Yes.
Okay? And I have a huge section on the chapter ingredient regarding soy sauce or soy flavor seasoning in the Asian vegetarian cooking.
So you've traveled to many, many countries learning about their cuisines. And many of the Asian countries use soy. Is anybody concerned about soy like we are over here in the United States? We're kind of nutty about soy here.
Oh, yeah. What do you mean by concern?
Okay, well, there's a lot of misinformation about soy, whether it's healthy or not healthy.
Oh, okay.
And some people are really afraid to consume soy foods. I am not one of them. Of all the studies I've read and the sources that I feel are credible, they say that soy foods are a healthy food. Not the highly processed soy foods like isolated soy protein that you find in a lot of these meat analogs, but
okay.
The simple soy foods are healthy.
Yes.
And
according to my research, I found it's very healthy also.
Okay. Absolutely.
And it's been some part of the Asia, soy is just the main protein of source of their diet also. Okay. And they've been eating soy for generations and generations.
I have a couple more questions.
Yeah.
This one I've been asking a lot of people lately, and I'm not sure if you have the answer, but I recently purchased mustard oil in an Indian store and brought it home and then noticed in very small print that it said for external use only. And I did some reading on the Internet, and people seem to say that it's used in Asia and in India, but for some strange reason, it's not approved for consumption in the United States. Have you seen other countries that use mustard oil in their cuisines?
Yes.
And it's okay.
Indians use mustard oil a lot, but instead of use it from the bottle of it, what they do is they heat the oil and put mustard in it. So the mustard releases the flavor into the oil.
Oh.
And then they use the oil for it.
I see.
Right.
So you could make your own that way.
That's right. So you use regular oil, like something that tasteless or odorless oil, and then you put mustard seed in it and you cook the oil, cook the mustard seed, then you have mustard oil in it.
Interesting.
Yeah. Then you know that when you grind mustard up, you're going to get some oil, right?
No, I don't. I've only shaken it from the jar.
So
you
right.
need to get the mustard seed.
That's right.
And then pound it like in a mortar and pestle.
Correct. Okay. And you're gonna get mustard powder. And if you powder more or heat it up, you're gonna get the oil. There's an oil in there, but it's very little, right? And you can have those. But the reason I haven't read the one that you say for external use only.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it for then, for external?
Well, it was with the food in this particular store, and my partner and I just like going around and trying new things, so we bought it. And then finally when we went to use it, we saw that it said external use, and so I went online and I looked. And there was some discussion about in the late 90s how there was a problem with some of it, and the United States said it's not good for consumption, and it was some isolated incident, but there are some issues about toxicity, and I didn't really find any clear information.
Okay.
And then I wrote to the USDA just to ask the question about it. And I got a pretty vague answer that said,
probably like my answer, because I haven't heard anything of the external use for mustard oil. But what I heard is in some parts of Asia, and when you got burned, you know, got hot water scald or burned, they put mustard on top of the burn.
Oh.
Yeah,
okay.
to help out in terms of burns, burning sensation, they put mustard on it. So that might be the reason they put for external use only.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I thought maybe is for medications also to help subside the heat on the burn.
You know, you live in the Bay Area.
Yes.
Yeah. Have you... Oh, well, you must. I'm going to ask a silly question. I don't know. There are a number of vegetarian Asian restaurants. There's a few in San Jose that I'm really fond of that are Vietnamese-based, and certainly a few in San Francisco. A lot of them use these faux meats, these meat analogs.
Use what?
they use fake meat.
Oh, okay.
Do you have any feeling about these soy-based meats or wheat gluten?
Well, you know, to substitute the meat product?
Yeah.
Well, I've seen them use a lot of them, okay? And I don't have any objection to it. Why did you bring it up?
Well, I didn't notice that you recommend using them in your books. And
no, I'm not.
Yeah.
But most of my ingredient is probably very basic that you can, you know, find in the grocery store. I try to strip everything down in terms of recipe just to get the original ingredient as much as possible. The further that I can go in terms of refined food will be the seasoning of soy and then the tofu.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. No further than that. Yeah.
I like it. That's good.
Yeah. So keep it simple, keep it, you know, straightforward. That is my philosophy.
Okay, I have one last question, and that's about, I don't know when your last trip to some of these countries was, but is the cuisine changing in Asia with the American influence like it is in other countries in Western Europe, et cetera?
Oh, yes. You just asked the right question. Okay. It changed tremendously.
Yeah, that's
first
unfortunate.
First of all, it changed on the size. Everything had been supersized, which is scary.
Yeah.
Okay? You learn so much about the restaurant in the United States. You know, if you pay extra 10 cents more, you get a bigger size and
right.
Things like that. It's just like, and in Asia, they're doing that everywhere. In order to entice people to buy more and eat more.
Mm.
And you don't need that much food in your diet.
That's right.
You don't need to supersize everything.
Well, I know a lot of people now, some of the more sensible ones, are in the habit of eating half of what they get in a restaurant and sharing it with someone or bringing it home. But we certainly don't need big, giant portions.
No, it's getting out of hand. And then one generation after the other doing that, and then at the end you don't know what's the proper size to eat anymore in terms of, you know, a meal.
Right.
Because everything is so huge and big and supersized in order to say that there's a value to this meal in terms of price-wise. Yeah.
And there's more dairy that's showing up in different Asian countries where it wasn't consumed at all at one point.
Correct, yeah, because you have all kind of butter and creams and thing that is not usual diet for the Asian people, okay? And the rate of obesity is also climbing up at the same time. Okay? When you look at how they consume all these dairy products.
Do you have any new books planned in the works?
I'm compiling the thing called Green Thai.
Oh.
Okay, so that means it's also raw, green and raw Thai.
Oh, there you go.
There you go. Because I start with Thai cooking, right, which is my specialty. I grew up with it. And then I convert our recipe into vegetarian Thai. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then I also offer cooking classes, which is vegetarian cooking classes, right? So I have many followers and students, and then they encourage me where we should convert all Asian cuisine into vegetarian.
Mm-hmm.
So I start with Thai, then I go with Vietnamese, okay? And then slowly go to every one of them. And then the Asian fusion is the mixture of all Asian cuisine. And then now we're going to go to raw Thai.
Yes. I've had a handful of.
I've had
a handful where you make noodles from the coconut.
Correct. Or from papaya. Or from daikons or something that have very neutral flavor.
Right.
So you can put sauce on it.
Okay, I have one last question. I think I said I had one last question before, but I keep thinking of more questions. In a lot of Asian restaurants, there are different things to look out for when you're a vegetarian, things that you want to avoid, the hidden ingredients. So in Chinese, there are particular ingredients. In Thai, there's particular ingredients, which is one reason why it's helpful to make your own. But are there certain things to look out for?
You mean in terms of seasoning?
Yeah.
Well, MSG for one thing, if you don't agree with it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then there is the wheat products that use a lot in seasoning, okay? And you probably have to look at it because some of them use preservative that or another product in order to keep the texture of their sauce and ingredients even.
Right.
Even the colors. Most of them are using colors in it also. So you need to be able to discern those by reading the labels a little bit. And after you buy one, and then you try them, and it does not agree with you in terms of taste or you have the reaction to it, then you need to find another product to substitute it.
Yeah, and you definitely have to read the labels.
Like. Yeah, that's right. And then try them first also. Okay? Because different cuisine have different. Let's say soy. We use a lot of soy in our vegetarian cooking, right? Each country have their own brand of soy products. It might start with Chinese first. It is, let's say it's the mother of all things in terms of soy products.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you get to Japanese cooking, to Thai cooking, to Filipinos and Malaysia, they also have own different brand of soy and different product with different ingredients in it. So if you want to cook Thai food, you have to use the soy that make in Thailand. So it tastes like Thai food.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But if you use another soy to use Thai food, the taste might not be like the one that you have in the restaurant. And you say it doesn't turn out because of the soy and ingredients in it.
Okay. I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Also in the restaurants, there's a lot of hidden animal ingredients. In Thai food, there's a fish powders.
Correct.
And sauces.
Yes.
That are used very frequently.
Mm-hmm.
And is it true in Thailand that a vegetarian is considered someone who can eat fish?
Yes, because when you say vegetarian in Thailand, Thai people would think that you don't eat the chunk of meat.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, like so obvious that you don't eat a chunk of meat because you're vegetarian. But when you come to fish sauce, which is not a chunk of fish,
right.
So they don't consider it meat because it's in the liquid form, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So when you ask for vegetarian cooking in Thailand, they might put fish sauce in it because it doesn't have a chunk of meat or fish in it. So
they do it here in the United States too.
That's right, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why when you go to Thailand, you say that. When you're a vegetarian, you say, I don't want fish sauce either.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to say that so they can use soy for it. But that is the misunderstanding about when you say vegetarian, you mean not a meat products at all, okay? Not just not a chunk of meat in your food.
Just like anything in life, you have to be very clear with what you want and communicate very
right.
well
uh-huh.
using many words.
That's right, yes. You need to be a little bit particular on that subject if you want to eat correctly.
Yes. Yes. Well, is there anything else you want to share with us?
Well, I had a great time here. I hope I have answered every question of you that you asked me. Okay?
I think you have.
Yeah, if some of the information is not clear, you know, maybe our listener might know more.
Mm-hmm.
They can let you know and we can share more next time. Especially
okay.
the one that about mustard seed and mustard oil. Yeah.
That's right. If anybody does want to make any comments or send questions, my email is info@realmeals.org. info@realmeals.org. Okay, well, Chet Minkwon, thank you so much. And I invite the listeners to check out your website, unusualtouch.com, and look into his cookbooks, Asian Fusion, and the others. They're really, really quite informative and very lovely.
Thank you so much for everything you do.
Thank you. And Top Kun in Thai means thank you also.
Oh, well. Merci.
Thank you, dear.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, well, that was Chat Ming Kwan, and I think we'll take a little break right now and be back in a few minutes. Glass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. And we have about a quarter of an hour left, maybe even a little less, and I've got a bunch of different things that I want to talk about. But if you do have any comments and questions, either now during the program or any time during the week, you can send me an email. I really look forward to them. info@realmeals.org. And you know the number here, don't you? It's a lot of eights with a few other numbers sprinkled in. 1-888-874-4888. 1-888-874-4888. I like the way it's framed on each side by three eights. Okay. So did my guest Chat Ming Kwan make you hungry? I really like making Asian style food. For I guess it was a couple of decades ago when the stir fry became quite a trendy thing and people started making them at home. And they can be really simple or they can be really complicated. It's true that in some of these particular books, the recipes may seem complicated at first because there are ingredients that you don't have and things that you have to pick up, and it can be overwhelming at first. But I think it's really worthwhile to open one of these books and check into it and take a day and find a lot of these ingredients and start using them, because it will add a lot of delicious variety in your life. And then once you're familiar with them, you can use them all the time, make your easy stir fries just a little more tasty. But one of the challenges with making a classic stir fry is that there's a lot of chopping. Lots of chopping. And that can really be a deterrent for somebody that wants something quick. Now, I don't mind chopping, and the more you chop, the better you get at it. So the first thing I say is practice. But there are different ways to get around it. And you may not be making a recipe as authentic with this particular thing I'm going to tell you about. But it is a way to do things fast, and that is using frozen vegetables. So there are many frozen vegetables. The simple ones that are just vegetables, like chopped broccoli or chopped spinach or the mix of peas and carrots and onions, these are great. And one of the reasons why they're great, we were talking before about how food tastes great when it's just freshly picked. Not only does fresh from the farm, freshly picked food taste great, but it's also filled with nutrition. And then that food, if it's going to the produce section in your supermarket, gets old. And it's old before you get to it and let it buy it and put it in your refrigerator and let it sit for a while, and then it gets older. And while it's aging, through the shipping process from harvest to the warehouse to the supermarket to your refrigerator and finally to your cutting board, it loses nutrition. And so this is where frozen vegetables can really be a plus. What happens is the vegetables are harvested and then they are quickly taken to the factory where they're frozen in a way that keeps the nutrients intact. And sometimes the frozen vegetables like these actually have more nutrition than the fresh produce you find in your supermarket. unbelievable. Of course, if you do have the opportunity to visit a farmer's market or participate in a CSA, community-supported agriculture, those fresh fruits and vegetables will be very fresh. That's my preferred choice. But in the frozen department, you can buy a lot of these already chopped frozen foods, and they're ready to go into an easy stir fry. And maybe thumbing through one of these books, like Asian Fusion, where you see some of the flavorings in it that you're not familiar with, you might try some of those, and that will give your dish a whole new look, a whole new feel, a whole new taste. I was talking about mustard oil before, and I really want to know more about this, so if anyone has any information, please send me an email at info@realmeals.org. And I thought it was interesting what Chot recommended, grinding up mustard seeds and putting it in oil. I'm not quite sure if that's what I have here at home that's labeled for external use, but I want to tell you what I did. I went to the USDA, and there's a place where you can send in questions. And I wrote a question, and the answer was kind of vague. It says, the USDA's Food and Safety Inspection Service inspects meat, poultry, and egg products at slaughter and processing plants, and that they can answer my question. So she sent me, the woman who answered this particular thing, sent me to another place to send an email, which I did. A consumer affairs specialist answered me and said, I believe that ingesting mustard oil can cause health issues, but I don't know what they are. I know it can be caustic at certain concentrations. Okay, to me, that was not an answer. I mean, what was the point of asking this question? Why couldn't she look it up for me and find out? But no, they do minimal, 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 and isn't that what we pay them for? So anyone that has information about mustard oil, I'd really like to find out about it, because I understand the flavor is really good, very buttery. And if it isn't an unhealthy product, I wouldn't mind trying it. There have been a number of studies or people talking about studies and coming up with their own conclusions, and I wanted to talk about a few of them. A few of them whose conclusions I don't agree with. And so they both involve being pregnant, for women who are pregnant, and what they should and shouldn't eat. So we've often heard that pregnant women should limit or avoid fish in their diets, and that's because of the mercury and other PCBs, toxic chemicals that are in the fish, and the fetus and that's growing in the pregnant mother is very sensitive to these toxins, and it can affect them in all kinds of ways, neurologically, in all different ways in development. And so Dr. Andrew Weil had a post on Huffington Post, and he was basically saying, based on a number of studies, it shows that pregnant women should be eating more fish. And this study in The Lancet, and it came out in 2007, so it's not even recent, but he's posting about it recently. And there were three groups that were compared: eating no fish, up to 12 ounces per week of fish, or more than 12 ounces per week. And those who ate no fish, their children subsequently had lower IQ. And, okay, I was screaming as I read this article, as I do when I read so many different articles. And that's because so many of these studies are poorly done, or maybe intentionally poorly done. So when I read about the three groups of women and they're eating different amounts of fish, my first question is, what else are they eating? Because it's important. So if the women that are eating no fish but are drinking Coke and eating potato chips and a lot of junk food, sure, their kids are not going to develop very well, because we need nutrients. We need nutrients, nutrition, in order for ourselves to be heavy and healthy and for our children to be healthy. So that was not clear. And so I feel like this reductionist kind of study where a lot of other things aren't considered or aren't mentioned makes it hard to really find it credible. And then a better one, I think, is the Environmental Working Group had an article that came out recently, and they talked about how prenatal pesticide exposure is linked to diminished IQ. So there are also toxic chemicals in pesticides, and women that are eating foods and drinking water that contain high levels of certain pesticides, lo and behold, it was found out in three particular studies that they were comparing that the IQ of their children was lower than normal. And, okay, I don't think this is groundbreaking information, but we need to have more studies like this in order to get the point across, because some of us know this already and choose to eat organic food all the time, not just for those women that are pregnant. I think it's important for all of us. So that's my take on these recent studies about what pregnant women should be eating. And it's, in some ways, it's like the canary in the mine. Pregnant women and their unborn children are more sensitive than the rest of us to certain things. But if we're going to be telling pregnant women not to consume things because it's going to negatively affect their unborn child, I don't want to eat it either. It's going to affect us too, just maybe a little bit more. Always wary. Now, the government has come out with something new, junk food guidelines. And I have a couple minutes, and I wanted to talk a little bit about this because it's kind of crazy. So we know that children are getting heavier, and childhood obesity is a huge concern, and diabetes, type 2 diabetes, is becoming more prevalent in young children, where we used to call it adult onset diabetes. And we know that it's because they're exposed to and eating a lot of very unhealthy food. And so this new interagency working group has been formed by the government, and they came up with a proposal, Food for Thought. And it's pretty good, their recommendations, and they're talking about unhealthy food being marketed to children, including breakfast cereals, snack foods, candy, dairy products, baked goods, carbonated beverages, fruit juice, non-carbonated beverages, prepared food, meals, frozen and chilled desserts, restaurant foods, etc. And they have some guidelines about how much sugar and sodium and fat should be, but here's the kicker. These guidelines are, number one, voluntary to the manufacturers, and number two, they don't go into effect until 2016. What's the point? The kids that are in school today, the young kids today, why should they be encouraged to consume foods that we know aren't healthy for them, that are ultimately going to lead to poor health, diabetes, and be taxing on our healthcare system? It's crazy. And so you can respond. You can go to, here's a website, ftc.gov/OPA/2011/04/foodmarket.shtm. There's a great article there, and they are welcoming comments in the next 45 days. Great. Well, there you have it. You've been listening to It's All About Food. I'm Karen Hartglass. And I hope you've enjoyed this hour as I have. Have a very delicious week.